Well, it's great to be with you this evening. And I guess I've got this question, why do I need God? And since you've just won the rugby, I'm guessing many of you are thinking, no, we don't. And they should have let you know that they actually put the end of the match up on the big screen in here. So the few of you who were here, there was a large cheer went up. So I take it that actually we have no Welsh visitors amongst us, because no one was crying. But the plan is I'm going to try and, as I say, see if I can make some sense of this question. When you've got an area as big as this, to try to cover all the bases up front is impossible. So I'm hoping it will just leave enough room for question for you to come back to me, ask me questions and or challenges or make statements. I'll try and do my best to respond to them. Now, obviously, the way the question's been structured, the way it's been given to me, why do I need God, is actually quite specific. It's not saying, is there one? But even if there is, why would I need one? Because many people do conclude that there is a God, but are very happy to think, actually, I think I'll try and live without him, thank you very much. One of the most famous professors of philosophy, professors of atheism, who were a philosopher for the last 30, 40 years, was a guy by the name of Anthony Flew, who produced the most widely reprinted philosophical article called Theology and Falsification of the 20th Century, which actually came out of, he had a debate with C.S. Lewis at Oxford University, where they were contemporaries together, and many people felt that this guy, Anthony Flew, had actually won, come out on top of that debate. And then he reworked that material into this particular philosophy article. I say it was reprinted in all kinds of journals all across the world. And for many, many years, if you went to the Secular Society's website or the Humanist Society's website, you would find that his book, An Introduction to Philosophy, was the basic philosophical textbook recommended if you wanted to be, you know, recommended reading for atheists. Now, that recommendation was pulled several years ago when Anthony Flew came out rather publicly announcing that he thought maybe there was a God after all. Then went on to write another book entitled There Is, well, actually printed, the printed title, There Is No God, but the way they printed it was it said there is no God, and then the word no had been scratched out with a red pen and the letter A written above that. So it just simply said there is a God. And it simply tells his story of how he moved from being an absolutely convinced atheist and actually indeed someone who had provided a lot of the arguments which you hear today against God. He had either helped pioneer or helped refine or helped phrase in a way to make them accessible to people. And how he'd moved from that to actually concluding now that actually there was a God after all. One of the stories he tells was how he did a whole series of debates which sort of shifted him slowly over the course of a couple of decades. And if you get the book and read it, it's not a very technical book, it's just simply his story. You have to go to all the footnotes and read all the stuff in the footnotes if you actually want to be taken much, much further through. But one of the stories he tells was how back in the 80s he was involved in a debate. And one of the things that he helped popularize, Anthony Flew, was he used to say, look, if you give enough monkeys typewriters, eventually they'll produce the works of Shakespeare. He said, so, you know, when we talk about, hey, look, maybe we need to find a God or have a God to explain all the complexities in life, that's really not that necessary. And he was involved in a debate with someone, and this person who he was debating with said, do you know, he says, that the British Arts Council have actually paid for a piece of research to done where they put a computer, a keyboard, in a cage with six monkeys and left it there for a while to see what would happen. And apart from using it as a toilet, they also produced 50 typed pages between them, but interestingly, not one single word, which is all the more interesting when you consider that the shortest word in the English language is either the letter A or I. But a word isn't a word unless it has a space either side of it. So if you have a basic keyboard of 26 letters and a few other keys, so let's suppose there are 30 altogether, the randomness of producing a single word by chance, he said, would be 1 by times 30 to 30 to 30, or 1 in 27,000. So the guy then said, well, look, what would be the chance, for example, of randomly generating a Shakespearean sonnet? Now, all Shakespearean sonnets are, by definition, 14 lines long. So he picked one, shall I compare thee to a summer's day? There are 488 letters in it. What's the chance of just randomly generating 488 letters in the right sequence? Well, the answer is 1 times 10 to the power of 690. In other words, if you imagine 10 with 690 zeros after it, and you put a 1 on the top, 1 divided by, that's the chance of doing it by random. That's quite a small number. To give you some idea, the total number of known particles in the universe, and we're not talking about grains of sand, we're talking about protons, neutrons, and electrons, is about 10 to the power of 80 particles in the universe. So that's 10 with 80 zeros after it. Which basically means there aren't enough particles in the universe to write down the trials, let alone do it. Anthony Flew then said that as he began to realize this, it was then pointed out to him, he says, supposing, however, he says, you took all the known matter in the universe and you converted it into microchips. Each microchip weighing a millionth of a gram, and each microchip is capable of producing random combinations of 488 letters 1 million times a second, and assuming, he said, that those computers have been running since the beginning of time, he says the number of different combinations they would have produced would have been 1 times 10 to the power of 90, which means you're still 10 to the power of 600 short, 10 with 600 zeros after it, the number too small to have done it. And then he says, and well, this was just one of the things that, as he began to think about it, he began to think, well, maybe some of the traditional lines that he's have pioneered and used are not as tightly formed as I had thought there was. But he has now come to a position where he believes that maybe there is a God, but he's not necessarily convinced that he needs God. And so when you ask the question, why do I need God, it is a slightly different question to saying, is there one? It's assuming that even if there is, maybe he's not necessary. And so it's, and there are so many different ways of handling and approaching this, as I say, and it's a bit difficult at times to know exactly what would be the best way of doing it. Now, when you also talk about why do I need something, it also assumes that you actually know what you need. And as someone has said, we actually live in a very highly educated yet emotionally illiterate culture. And we're not always sure exactly what we need, and sometimes what we think we need when we get, we actually realize that we didn't need it. Men and gadgets, for example, normally illustrate this point very, very well. And of course, we also now live in a time where a lot of people feel, especially when they see the amount of war and violence that may be committed in the name of religion and when it comes to God, would actually say, actually, the whole society as a whole would be much better off without it. Thank you very much. So it's not even just simply the fact that maybe this is right or wrong. It's not even that. It's just, look, this is not a good idea, and we need to get away from it. And obviously, many of you here would have been involved, you know, through your the course of you living here, have actually seen the disastrous outworking of that. And I'd just like to start off by saying that if your experience of Christianity has been overwhelmingly negative, then first of all, I would just like to say just a couple of things to that. A few years ago, I was asked to give a talk in a particular setting, and they said, the title we want you to speak to, because I don't come up with my own titles, because I'm just too lazy to do that. I ask other people to give me the titles or the questions. They said, the title we want you to speak to is, Has the Christian Faith Failed You? And we'll advertise it, and people will come. And I wrote back, and I said, this isn't really the kind of thing I do. I'll give a talk on more like, why should you be a Christian? And they said, no, we want you to talk on, has the Christian faith failed you? We think that a lot of people will come. And we think this will resonate with a lot of people. And I said, first of all, I'm not sure it will resonate. And secondly, seems awfully negative. I don't know if I really want to do it. Anyway, the venue they used was a big theater that would seat 5,000 people. And they had to issue tickets. No, and the tickets were free. They weren't being sold. There was just to make sure there were 5,000 seats and health and safety and all this kind of stuff. You know, everyone had to have a ticket so they knew how many people were coming. The organizers said, actually, we have thought about not bothering issuing tickets in your case because so few people are going to come to this event. But, you know, we have to issue the tickets as well. So, you know. Anyway, every single ticket disappeared. And then some people who'd taken free tickets and then couldn't come to the event started auctioning them off on eBay. And then people started complaining that we were trying to make money out of this event and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, that wasn't fair. And we had to point out it wasn't us who was doing it. It was these people who had these tickets. Quite clever people, obviously. And it was interesting simply to see the level of interest in that particular question. Because for a lot of people, they felt that it has failed. And for a lot of people, the reason why they felt it had failed was simply because of the Christians and the Christianity which they'd seen. And it had put them off incredibly. Now, interestingly, right from the very word go, right from the beginning of the Christian faith, and ever since Jesus Christ came and walked on this planet and the church was set up, one of the big battles the church has always had and Christians have always had is to say, look, what is a real Christian and what isn't? What is true Christianity? What simply looks like Christianity but is false? What does it truly mean to be a Christian? What does it mean to be pretending to be a Christian? And one of the very first pieces of literature ever written by a Christian to a group of people in a part of the world called Galatia, one of the very first Christians, a guy called the Apostle Paul, he wrote to them and he was very concerned and he said, look, don't be fooled by people who are claiming to be Christians but aren't. He says, if you meet someone who says they are a Christian, there should be a fruit in their life. Okay, a single fruit. And it should taste of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, self-control and so on. He says, that's what it should taste like. He said, if you meet someone who claims they are a Christian and you taste their life, then what you should taste should be that. He said, if, however, what you taste isn't that, instead you meet murder, lust, envy, strife, and all of those things, not only do you have the right to question whether they are a Christian, you have every right to challenge them and say, wait a minute. Where is the reality of this in your life? It seems to be wholly and totally absent. So the first thing I'd like to say is, for those of you who have met, and your encounter of Christianity has been one that's been very negative, first of all, I would love to apologize for that. But I find it interesting that even within the Bible itself, there are some very strong words which are said about what does it mean if someone goes around claiming they are a Christian? What should their life look like? What is the reality of what should actually be there? And then encouraging people to look for that reality and pursue it and go after it. Now, I know that we live in a very, very cynical age. It's been interesting. A whole bunch of psychological studies have been done recently that linked especially TV watching with cynicism. And in media-driven cultures, we seem to become increasingly cynical. As a matter of fact, quite a long time ago, back in 1977, the Detroit Free Press in North America did an experiment where they asked for families to give up watching television for 1 month, and they would give them $500 and then monitor them psychologically to see how they coped. They had to ring up 200 families before they found five that were willing to give up TV for a month to get $500. $500 for me is a lot of money today. $500 30 years ago was a serious amount of money. The families that agreed were then monitored. It was very interesting. The families that gave up TV suffered classical withdrawal symptoms. The amount of violence increased. The use of tranquilizers, drugs, and smoking went up dramatically within those families. One woman reported to the clinical psychologist reporting on this, and I quote, "It was terrible. We did nothing. My husband and I talked." And so we are in a very, very interesting culture, and I realized that that is the case. And I hope this evening, for those of you who are either feeling cynical or skeptical or unsure, will at least provide the opportunity to raise some issues and some questions, and then for me to try and do my best to try and answer them. Now, what I want to try and do in terms of framing my remarks is I'd actually like to borrow an outline from a different speaker, from a guy, classical Greek guy called Aristotle, who wrote a book called The Politics. He wrote a book called Rhetoric, sorry. And in his book, The Rhetoric, he put some of his comments about to do with the use of rhetoric and listening to speeches under three main headings. And I'd like to take those headings and use them in a slightly different way for the purposes of what I want to say today. But he talked about ethos, pathos, logos. Ethos, pathos, logos, if you like. And what I'd like to do is try to phrase my remarks on why do we need God under those three general headings. Now, I'm going to also make a very dangerous assumption, which is this. It's absolutely... And because of the comments I made about, we're not talking about whether there is a God necessarily, although I'm happy to go back to that, but whether we need God, I'm going to talk slightly more on the what do we need side. Now, the danger with doing that, and I realize there is a very big danger, is then you can say, well, yes, but this is just simply a psychological crutch. And as I travel around the world, an awful lot of people sometimes say something like this to me: look, Michael, we're very happy that you're a Christian, and you know, you seem to be very happy that you're a Christian, and that's great, and I wish I could believe what you believe, but I can't. Now, I'm the kind of guy, when I hear something said to me in more than one different culture by more than one different people, I like to go away and think about it. And I thought, why do people say this? And what they're basically saying is this: look, Michael, you seem to be very happy as a person, and that's great. I'm happy that you're happy. As a matter of fact, the kind of happiness and joy and fulfillment you have in life, I actually find attractive. But the reason you seem to have this happiness and joy is because you are a Christian. It's because you believe in Jesus. In other words, you believe in something that isn't there. Now, what do you call people that believe in things that don't exist? And the answer is mad people. So what they're actually saying is, Michael, you are insane. But the main thing is that you are happy and insane. I am happy that you are happy. As a matter of fact, I'm so desperate to know this kind of joy that you talk about, I too would embrace insanity just to join you, and I've thought about it, but I just can't. Now, that is a misunderstanding of the nature of the term faith as it is used, certainly within biblical writing. In today's culture, the idea of faith is what you have when you want to believe something, but you don't know whether it's true or not. Does that make sense? So it would be nice if it were true, and you can sort of get fairly close, but you really can't get there. And so you close your eyes and you take a huge leap of faith, and then all of a sudden you can believe. So faith, therefore, is believing in something which you think, or you would like to be true, but you're not sure is. Strong faith, therefore, is believing in something that you suspect isn't true, and yet you're still able to believe it, because obviously it requires a bit more conviction. And the strongest possible kind of faith you would have would be when you know it's not true and you're still able to believe it, because how much faith do you need then? Now, it is true that the Bible talks about faith as a gift, but it's not the gift of insanity. It's not a gift that enables you to believe something that isn't there. As a matter of fact, the way the Bible defines faith is very radically different to the way some modern-day atheists insist on defining faith, which is interesting, because there's a bit of a debate going on at the moment. theologians, and particularly Christian theologians, have always defined faith for the last few thousand years in exactly the same way. Now, what has happened is that word has evolved, and there are a group of people who are insisting, actually, no, this word means what we want it to mean, as opposed to simply taking as it how it is intended. But the way the word faith is used throughout the entire Bible is in the same way in the English language you would use the word faith if you said, look, I have faith in X. Suppose I also say to you, look, I have faith in, the British Prime Minister. Now, you may question my sanity, but when I say I have faith in the British Prime Minister, I'm making two statements. Number one, that there is a real person. Okay? It's a statement about reality. Even if you didn't want him to exist, tough. Okay? He's there. And secondly, that I believe he is trustworthy, that he is true. Okay? That I can trust what he's saying, I can rely on the promises that he makes. When you say I have faith in someone, you're making a statement about reality and truth. Now, that's exactly the way in which the Bible uses the word faith. When it talks about having faith in God, it's very interesting in one of the books of the Bible, in the book of Hebrews, it says, without faith it is impossible to please God. And then it goes on to define faith. And faith, it says, is knowing, one, that he is. That's a statement of reality, that God exists. And two, that he rewards those who earnestly seek him, which is a statement about his trustworthiness. You can trust him. Okay, if he promises something, then you may rely on him. He is morally trustworthy. In other words, faith is a response to truth and reality. Now, I'm happy to very much come back to it, but that's the way in which it is defined. Which is why nowhere in the Bible does it talk about faith as being as a leap into the dark, but the metaphor it always uses is a step into the light, okay, which is a reverse of how it may be popularizedly, in a popular way, talked about. Okay, so as I said, but I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time just on that. I want to just talk about this issue of, do we actually need him? Even if he were there, is it necessary? And I say, I'd like to put my comments under three general headings: ethos, pathos, logos. First of all, ethos. Now, it's interesting, when Aristotle talked about ethos, he said, look, whenever you're listening to a rhetorician speak, the question you should ask is not what is the moral standard that they advocate, but what is the moral standard they live by? Do you understand the difference? Not is it what are they telling you how should you live, okay, what moral demands they're making of you. The question you should ask is, what does their life actually look like? In other words, can you trust them? Can you rely on them? Now, this issue of trust has become an absolutely enormous one in our current culture. It's very interesting. For the last 25 years, we've been teaching everyone at university that ethics is relative, and now we have a group of bankers who've treated ethics like relative, and we're not actually happy with what they're doing. Now, that's a whole other talk and presentation, and I'll be talking a bit about that tomorrow morning in one of the talks I'll be giving. But you have to ask the question, who do you trust? Who is it? Let me ask you another question. Are we actually trustworthy? Now, one of the things that I enjoy about the Christian faith, although some people really don't like it at all, is it basically says the answer to that question is no. We're not basically good people. None of us in this room, including me, are basically good people. Now, we just don't like that idea. It sounds awfully negative. I don't know if you know the story about a boy who was praying for a bicycle for Christmas. And he asked his parents, he'd made it very clear to everybody what he wanted for Christmas was a bicycle. And come Christmas Eve, he'd searched the whole house and there were no bicycle-shaped presents to be found anywhere. So he began to panic a little bit, and eventually he got out of bed, he got down on his knees and he said, okay, God, I tell you what, I'll make you a deal. I really want a bicycle for Christmas, that's all I want. So you send me a bicycle and I'll be good for a whole month. Okay, 1 month, I won't do anything wrong, just make sure the bicycle's there tomorrow morning. Gets back into bed, amen, tries to go to sleep, he can't sleep. A month is a very long time. He keeps remembering how often he gets into trouble at school. He thinks, I'm not going to be able to keep up a month. So he gets out of bed, he gets back down on his knees. He says, okay, God, how about this? He says, I'll be good for 1 week. Okay, for one whole week, I won't do anything wrong. I'll do everything right. I won't, I promise you. I'm making this commitment to you right now. I'll be good for a week. I just want the bicycle. Thank you, Jesus. Amen. Gets into bed. Then he starts to think about a week. And he starts to think, he's always getting into trouble with his mother. Doesn't tidy his room, doesn't clear things away, putting muddy boots on the floor, always getting told off, and he thinks, actually, a week, I'm not going to be able to do that either. He gets back out of bed. He says, okay, Lord, how about this? 1 day. I'll be good for a day. You just send me the bicycle. I want a bicycle for Christmas. You just make sure it's there. I won't do anything wrong tomorrow. Gets back into bed, begins to think about his sister and how annoying she can be. And how, he can say she keeps touching me and then she just sits there with her finger just sort of just slightly millimeters away from his shoulder. And if the finger makes contact, he always claims that, he moved. It wasn't her finger that moved. And he just thinks, actually, no, that's not going to work either. And then he suddenly remembers there's a very small, very sort of high Presbyterian chapel just across the road, very formal setup, and he just thinks, you know what, he decides he's gonna sneak out of the house. So he sneaks out of the house, he crosses the road, and the door to the church is open. He goes in. There's on his left hand side, there's a small little statue, there's a little alcove with a statue of Mary in it, and he just takes it, closes the door, crosses the road, gets back into bed, or gets back into his room rather, puts the little statue in his closet, closes the door and locks it, gets down on his knees, and he says, "Okay, Jesus, if you ever want to see your mother again." None of us are as good as we like to think we are. If we're prepared to be honest, there's something that runs through our nature. We're not good people. Which is why the understanding and the concept of forgiveness is very important within the Christian faith. To become a Christian isn't to become morally superior to anybody else. But it's to simply recognize the fact, part of it is to recognize the fact that we need to be forgiven. And it's interesting, when you meet genuine, real forgiveness, it seems to also often change who you are. It can bring about change and transformation. Now, sadly, we also live in a culture, because of the cynicism that is prevalent and exists, is that some people like to take advantage of this and will feign all kinds of repentance and forgiveness in order to try to win the approval of other people. But that's not what I'm talking about. Okay. Is it the case that we need genuine forgiveness? It's very, very interesting, again, if you read through some various different psychological and even psychiatric journals. One psychiatrist very famously declaring a little while ago that if he could offer his patients true forgiveness, then the vast majority of cases with which he was battling would be solved. It's interesting to see how much we struggle. I remember I was talking once in South Africa, and at the end of it, this guy came up to me and he started asking me all of these questions, and then he said, "Look, I'm not a Christian, but I'd like to continue this conversation." So I said, "That's fine." I said, "Look, I'm actually speaking in various other cities, but I will be back in this city in about 12 days' time. Would you like to get together?" He said, "That's fine." I said, "Look, why don't you write down on a sheet of paper all the questions that you have so you can think them through, and then when I come back, you can make sure you ask me the questions you really want to ask." So 12 days later, I'm back in the city. I ring him up. "Do you still want to meet?" He says, "Yes." Someone drops me off at the house. I walk in. He and I sit down. He hands me a sheet of paper. There are 24 questions on it. I said, "These are a lot of questions." I said, "How much time have you got?" He said, "Well, we'll just do as many as we can." I said, "Are they in the order you want them asked, or are there some that are more important than others?" He said, "Oh, it doesn't matter. Just start at the top and work down the list." I said, "Okay, fine." We got to question number five. Question number five was, "You talked about our need for forgiveness." He said, "Do you know how hard it is to forgive yourself, let alone to forgive anyone else?" I said, "That's a very honest question." I said, "Not many people are prepared to ask that." I said, "It is very hard to forgive yourself. I don't have a problem with that." I said, "The understanding as a Christian I would have is that if it is true that God, who knows and sees everything, is able to forgive us, that becomes the basis on which we may be ultimately be able to forgive ourselves and find true peace with ourselves." And we talked about it for about 5 or 10 minutes. He said, "Okay, that's great." Question number six was, "I'm a good person. Why do I need Jesus?" I said, "Well, we were just talking about forgiveness." He said, yeah, but I'm basically good. I haven't done anything really wrong." So I said, "Really?" I said, "What were you worried about in number five? Question number five, do you know how hard it is to forgive yourself? What are you hiding in the closet?" I said, "Do you want to tell me what it was? What was bothering you about when you asked question number five?" He said, no, "I don't want to talk about that, but I'm basically okay." We talked for about 20 minutes and eventually said, "You know what, you're right. I'm not a good person after all." He says, "I do need this kind of forgiveness." Now, of course, this doesn't mean, therefore, that God exists. It just means that it's something that we seem to find is a universal need. Ethos, what is the standard we live with? Most of us don't even meet our own standards, let alone the standards of other people. Is there means for forgiveness? Secondly, pathos. What is it that drives us? What is it that gives passion to life? What is it when you wake up in the morning makes you think, "Yes, I want to live, and this is a great day, and I'm very happy to be here. Thank you very much." Now, it's probably a sad fact that a lot of people think that Christian faith is basically about duty. Okay? There are certain things that you should do and various duties that you should perform, one of which is going to church. One Christian writer, a guy called Carnell, said this. He said, "Look," he said, "supposing a man comes to his wife and says, 'Darling, must I kiss you goodnight each night?'" He said, "What would she say? 'Must I kiss you goodnight each night?'" You know, it's very It's interesting, it's occurred to me, because it's Mother's Day tomorrow. There's a story, you know, of an Anglican bishop who was asked to do a Mother's Day Sunday sermon broadcast, and he was in a little radio van. And they brought a radio van round to his house, and they wanted him to speak at 6 o'clock in the evening on Sunday, give a talk on Mother's Day. He had no idea what he was going to say, and he remembered there was a very big church nearby where he lived that was very popular, so he thought he would go on Sunday morning and see what the guy was going to say. So he went to the church, and the guy stood up at the front, and he said, today, I found myself in the embrace of a woman who was not my wife. And all the church members went, and then he said, it was my mother. And everyone went, ah. And the bishop thought, that's fantastic. He says, that's a great way to open. I'm going to open with that when I'm on the radio. That's a really good opening story. So anyway, later that evening, he's in the radio van. And he's sitting there, and he's just looking at the microphone, and the little red light comes on, and he takes his big breath, and he goes, this morning, I found myself in the embrace of a woman who was not my wife. And then his mind just went blank. I don't know if that's ever happened to you. Mind went complete blank. He just couldn't remember what the punchline was. He just couldn't. And he just hung his head and whispered into the microphone, but for the life of me, I can't remember who it was. Anyway. I'm not talking about passion just in terms of relationships you may have with other people. That's not what I'm talking about. What is it that actually makes it worthwhile? And it's a sadness, maybe, that the Christian faith is being portrayed in terms of nothing more than raw duty. But there's a problem with understanding something in terms of raw duty, because there's a kind of duty that doesn't honor your country, doesn't honor your wife, and it certainly doesn't honor God. And that would be a duty that is devoid of all forms of joy. When I go home tomorrow, I've brought my wife. She's got a little Mother's Day card, and she's collecting blue and white mugs at the moment. Don't know why I've all different shapes and sizes. Why they can't all be the same, I'm not sure, but they all have to be different. And so I found a little blue and white mug. And I'm going to buy her a bunch of flowers. Okay, so, you know, I've been away. I get home tomorrow. Okay, what I'll do is I'll knock on the door, okay, and she'll open the door, and I'll step from just into the door with the flowers, and I'll go, ta-da! Okay, so imagine I do that, I hand over the flowers, she takes the flowers, she looks and says, Michael, these flowers, they're beautiful, you shouldn't have, why did you? And I say, it was my duty. There's something sort of deficient in that answer, isn't there? Profoundly deficient. It somehow just doesn't seem to capture. Because that's the wrong way of looking at it. It's like this Christian writer is saying, well, if a guy says, must I kiss my wife goodnight each night? If he says that to his wife, darling, must I kiss you goodnight each night? The answer is, well, you must, but it's not that kind of must. It's not just a mechanical kind of observant. That's not it. It has to be filled with joy. Part of the answer is that you want to do this, that you delight in doing this, that it brings you pleasure to do this, that you're delighting it, and it brings delight to the basis of doing it. And that is very, very honouring to someone. Now, the difficulty is that because we have what's called a neo-Kantian system of ethics that overhangs our culture, which I don't particularly want to give you a long lecture about Immanuel Kant, but basically, Immanuel Kant's, part of his understanding of ethics was, look, for something to have moral value, moral beauty, he says, you must do what you don't want to do. He said, so for example, he says, let's take helping the poor. Let's suppose you love helping the poor. You delight in serving them and helping them and reaching out to them. He says, that has no moral value. You're just doing what you want, what gives you pleasure. It's selfish. However, he said, let's suppose you hate the poor, you can't stand the sight of them, okay? You like nothing more than to spit on them and kick them out of your way, but you help them. Now it has moral value because you're doing something that you hate doing. And of course, most people have this view of church too, that even if there is a moral value going to church, the reason that's moral value is you hate it so much and you have to put up with an awful lot of boring stuff, a bit like tonight. Now, but that's completely wrong understanding of the idea of duty and moral compulsion within the Christian faith. The moral compulsion in the Christian faith is meant to be one that is actually filled with passion and delight, something you delight and enjoy in doing, that you derive pressure from. Now, people this at some point they say, well, that doesn't sound right. It sounds selfish. It means that some of these things that you do because you love them and you get pleasure from them. And that can't be right, can it? That would seem to be very self-centered. So let's supposing tomorrow, buy my wife the flowers. I ring, knock on the door. We don't have a doorbell. I knock on the door. Hey, she opens the door. I stand there. Ta-da! Give her the flowers. She takes the flowers and she looks at them and she says, Michael, these flowers are beautiful. You shouldn't have. Why did you? And I say, because I know it makes you happy, and it makes me happy to see you happy. As a matter of fact, I've arranged a babysitter tonight. We're going to our favourite restaurant in Oxford because there's nothing I would rather do, and there's no one I would rather be with, and no one I'd rather spend time with than you. My wife never looks at me and says, what do you mean there's nothing you wouldn't rather do? Why don't you think about me sometime? You're so selfish! She doesn't say that because it is the nature of love to delight yourself in the other. Something's gone wrong in a loving relationship when that isn't the case. Now, that doesn't mean that you walk away if you suddenly find yourself in a position of dryness, not at all. But what it means is it's the sign of a healthy, loving relationship when that is what is informing you and driving you, what is motivating you. And it should be exactly the same with God. If it is true that we were created in his image and somehow we find completion within him, then you would expect this to be the case. Which is why very often if you talk to people who've, especially people who've become Christians in adulthood, they normally don't say, yeah, I've become a Christian and I feel terrible about it. Before I became a Christian, I was miserable and depressed. God's turned my life around, now I'm depressed and miserable. You know, the reason they don't normally say things like that, because there's now a consummation, a completeness, something that has come in that informs and drives every single area and aspect of life. What is it for you that gives and drives that passion? Where does it come from? Where is it found? What gives it? Pathos. What is the pathos that informs your life? What are you doing here? Thirdly, logos. The idea of a logos obviously comes from the Greek word, and the way Aristotle used it obviously was very much in the terms of, you know, if you're going to be a rhetorician or you're going to speak, you have to be very careful with your words and how you choose your words and what are the meaning of words and what's actually being said. Now, I'd like to just change that slightly. You see, a lot of us don't particularly need a word to inform our life. And again, maybe it's a tragic misunderstanding of the Christian faith that most people, when they look at Christianity and so on, think, well, look, Christianity is basically about you try to do good things. And you try to do the right thing, even if you don't want to. In other words, it's a word that informs your life. It tells you how to live. And if we're honest, what it tells us, we don't really like. And sometimes the church, sometimes we go a little bit overboard and we decide that we'd like to be even holier than maybe at times the Bible told us to. And so we tell people they can't do things when actually maybe they can. And therefore, the church is always seen as some kind of big moral, you know, endeavor that somehow either makes people feel guilty and manipulates them through guilt, is all the time telling them what to do. I don't know if you know the story of a pastor who was in a church, and he decided he'll preach a temperance sermon, and he's standing behind the pulpit, and as he comes towards the end of this great thundering message, he gives it a huge whack, and it reverberates through the building. He says, what I'm saying is this, if I had all the beer in the world, I'd throw it in the river. Hits it again, even harder. He says, and if I had all the wine in the world, I'd throw it into the river. Then hits it again a third time, even harder. He says, if I had all the whiskey in the world, I'd throw it into the river. And at this point, the guy who was like leading the singing was feeling a little bit rebellious, and so as the pastor sat down, he came up to the front of the church. He said, there's been a change in the program. Why don't we all sing that old spiritual song, 454, Shall We Gather at the River? That's not what is driving. We don't particularly, most of us, need a word to inform our life, someone to come along and tell us what to do. What we normally need is a word that's capable of transforming our very life. I was in Pakistan a few years ago, and I'd been talking to an audience, and there was a time of open Q&A, and at the end of it, one of the guys who stood up was a clinical psychiatrist, and he just said, you talked about our need to trust God. My question to you is this, can God trust us? I thought, wow, that's a good question. I said, you know, that's a very interesting question. In the Gospel of John, it said Jesus Christ didn't entrust himself to the crowd because he knew what was in the hearts of people. I said, but I think ultimately he does want to trust us, but before he can trust us, he must first transform us and change us. What lies at the heart of becoming a Christian is a transformation of the heart and of who you are. Something that changes you. I don't know if you've ever known that kind of transformation. What lies at the heart of the Christian faith isn't just simply giving assent to a set of ideas or promising to lead a certain type of moral life, or promising to perform certain spiritual acts. That's not ultimately what it's about. Although it's true, there are things that will change how you believe and how you act and what you do. What lies at the heart of it is the promise of a transformation, a change of the heart. Something that transforms, doesn't just simply inform our existence, but transforms our existence and changes us. A few months ago, I was in a country that I can't name. And I was sat there in front of a guy who's been, for the last, up until a few years ago had been trained and was fighting with an organization called the Taliban, which I assume most of you have heard of. And he spent his life during that time doing all kinds of things that really he never should have been doing. And even within his own country, that particular organization is regarded with deep hatred by the people because life is now so unstable in this particular country, and it's become so hard and so difficult and so impossible with so much bloodshed that even ordinary people who once supported that group now just feel they've just simply, they're not even sure whether they just live in fear. And it was interesting talking to him. 3 years ago, he became a Christian. So he turned his back on the violence that he so willingly embraced. And now, he travels out to talk with the very people he once fought with. Talking about how Jesus Christ has changed his heart and his life, the forgiveness he's known. He refuses to carry weapons or arms and pleads with them to do the same. And you can imagine the country he's in, these people don't just simply either politely listen or indeed they're not even rude to him. You know, he is assaulted and shot at and everything else that you could possibly imagine. But it is changed, it has transformed his very existence. We don't just simply need a word to inform, we need a word to transform. Jesus Christ claims to be that living word that's able to transform our life. A lot of people think that Christianity is about trying to pull your socks up and do better. That simply isn't the case. It's not about trying to pull up your socks and do better. Okay? It is about recognizing the fact that we do need to be forgiven. Okay? That maybe the reason we were made and one of the main reasons why we're here is so that we might ultimately find fellowship with God and to know the very transformation of our heart and our life. Before I became a Christian, I was talking to a group of people, and because I was sort of basically happy before I became a Christian. I wasn't deeply unhappy or disturbed. As a matter of fact, I used to feel about Christians the same kind of way at times I used to feel about communists. You know what they used to say? I don't trust communists. They have nothing, but they want to share it with you. And I sort of felt the same way with many of the Christians I met. But there were some that really did challenge me quite deeply. And I was having a long conversation with them, having been joined a group for 6 months, and we met every week, and I used to ask all kinds of difficult questions. And at the end of this particular time, I just said, okay, look, let me give you a picture. I said, imagine life is like a swimming pool. I said, and all my friends are in the shallow end of the pool. I said, I'm actually enjoying myself. I'm doing well, I'm having fun, and I'm having, you know, things are going great. So when you ask me to become a Christian, it feels like you're asking me to get up, walk along the edge of the pool and jump into the deep end, and I don't even know if I can swim. So maybe there are sharks in the deep end. I've always had quite a vivid imagination. And the guy I was talking to said, Michael, I said, I've been in the deep end of that pool, he said, for 13 years, and I haven't drowned and I haven't been eaten by sharks. But if you remain in the shallow end of the pool of life, you'll only ever experience this much of it. As I walked away, I realized as I walked away that evening that I'd already come to the conclusion that I believed that what I've been told about the Christian faith was true and real. But I wanted somehow it to be true and real, but never to actually affect or impinge on my own existence, if that makes sense. And I walked away that afternoon feeling very unhappy with the fact that actually maybe if this was true and real, it was going to have to change my life and I was going to have to do something about it. And I can remember later that evening, I went and found a group of my friends, and I said, I think I'm going to become a Christian, so you need to know from now on I won't be having any more fun in life. I actually said that to them. I honestly felt like I was sacrificing on the altar of truth my only great shot at happiness. And when I found some Christians, I'd like you to pray with me, I'm going to become a Christian. And then, to paraphrase what a very well-known Christian from this part of the world said, I was then very greatly surprised by joy, and far from sinking into a pit of despair. Even though I thought what I now believe was true, what I actually found and discovered was something very, very different. Anyway, you have listened to me very well, and you all seem to be still awake, which is remarkable.